Thank you very much, and of course it is a pleasure because we surely feel that we have a very fine lectureship that has been in progress. Very much appreciate the great work that Devin has done as the director of this lectureship, and a tremendous thanks goes to so many individuals who have been a tremendous part of it. Not only in seeing that the facilities are clean, but preparing the food and so many different other tasks that have gone into making the lectureship what we surely believe and know is a success. In so many instances when things of this nature tend to go smoothly and you think how easy it must have been, chances are it's simply because a lot of people put in the effort to make it so. And that, of course, has been the case here. I would take a moment to reemphasize the lectureship book, and if you haven't acquired it, by all means, suggest that you do so. I think it will be a fine asset to your library, but I would also encourage you to take the Gospel Journal if you're not doing so. And there's a hardbound volume that's produced each year of all the volumes of that year. And if you're like me, it's difficult to hold on to the individual copies. But when you have the hardbound edition that has an index that assists you greatly in finding the different articles by the different writers and the passages that are referred to, it's a tremendous asset to your library, and would urge that you get that. I want to turn over then to the 25th chapter of the book of Jeremiah, and some aspects of this will not be found in the book, but nevertheless, hopefully you'll find as being appropriate. Perhaps I should have contained it within the book, but be that as it may, sometimes we may be inclined to miss some of the factors that flow as a part of what is going on. And it may be that it makes it more difficult for us to make a transition from the events that were occurring then and the lessons that might be learned to the present day and time. And in so many instances, it's quite likely that as we look back at what is recorded, that we're doing so as armchair generals or coaches, where obviously it's very easy to see what it was that they not only were doing wrong, but how God was either pleased or displeased with them. And sometimes it would be nice if we had a lot more than is revealed, but obviously we have to go with what is there and hopefully not make too much conjecture with regard to it. We began this 25th chapter by the statement that the word that came to Jeremiah concerning all the people of Judah in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, that was the first year of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. I think it helps if we take note with regard to some of the factors that related to him becoming king. And I don't want to go over too much of what has already been touched on with regard to the various kings, particularly after Josiah. But I think, as is often the case, when somebody understands ourselves, for example, and what has been in our past, how we came to be where we are, then they can better appreciate and understand why we say and do the things that we do. It doesn't necessarily make it right, but we have a better grasp with regard to the nature of the individual. If you go back to the 23rd chapter of 2 Kings, and of course this is after the death of Josiah, and we find in the 33rd verse that we have Pharaoh that comes, and he replaces the king that is there at that time, and he put the land in tribute, and he has made Jehoiakim the king. And here, having made him the king, he puts the land under tribute. And what we're told is that he put the land to a tribute of 100 talents of silver and 1 talent of gold. And as you go down into verse 35, and Jehoiakim gave the silver and the gold to Pharaoh, but he taxed the land to give the money according to the commandment of Pharaoh. He exacted the silver and the gold of the people of the land, of every one according to his taxation, to give, of course, unto Pharaoh. He is therefore under subjection to that nation. And we, of course, can appreciate that Egypt was something of a power of that day and time. That Babylon was, of course, also a power. You can appreciate, hopefully, that this puts the nation of Judah in something of a bind, because they are very close to Egypt. Pharaoh has already removed the king, has put another man on the throne, and has made them pay tribute. If you continue to read into the 24th chapter, we find that after 3 years, well, first of all, the land came under the subjection of Babylon, and then after 3 years, Jehoiakim rebelled. This puts the situation in a bit of a bind, or the potentially so. And we want to take note with regard to some of this, of course, as we continue to proceed. Well, we see something then with regard to what is occurring and the general time frame. But we might move on just a little bit further into the book of Jeremiah, taking note already that the event that we have just started in chapter 25 is in the 4th year of the reign of Jehoiakim. If you go on over to chapter 36, and notice the very first verse there as well. And here you will see that it came to pass in the 4th year of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, that the event that's about to unfold there. Very likely then in the very same year. Don't know exactly the time frame otherwise, but in close proximity to what's recorded there in chapter 25. Now this is the account where the roll or scroll is written or dictated by Jeremiah to a scribe. He's locked up at that time, and the scribe brings this to the attention of other scribes. It's brought ultimately before those that are listed as being princes, and there is some discussion with regard to this. We note the reaction of these men and what they ultimately tell the scribe that has brought this scroll from Jeremiah. In verse 19, the princes said to him, "Go hide thee, thou and Jeremiah, and let no man know where you are." Having done this, the scroll now is ultimately presented to the king. This is the same one that we're talking about in chapter 25. You remember the account with regard to this, that there was a fire there, and as read the scroll, that he took a knife and he simply cut it up and put it in the fire. You see the reaction of those, or lack of reaction, by those who are standing, or very likely standing, but in any event, in his presence. Verse 24 tells us, "Yet they were not afraid, nor rent their garments, neither the king nor any of his servants that heard all these words." However, if you look at the next verse, it didn't include everyone, because several are mentioned by name that made intercession to the king that he would not burn the roll, but he would not hear them. So we're getting something of an interplay that is taking place between those individuals who have access to the king, and also you're seeing more with regard to the nature of this man. Well, we might turn back to the 26th chapter, pick up a little bit more with regard to the nature of what is going on and the interplay between the king and those who are in a position to be of influence to the king. The Lord has told Jeremiah to go and stand in the court of the house, and he's to speak. And he does. He speaks out with regard to what the Lord is going to do. And part of the language is, he says, I'll make this house like Shiloh and will make this city a curse to all the nations of the earth. And the priests and the prophets, they, of course, heard all of this. And so having heard what he had to say, we're told in verse 10, when the princes of Judah heard these things, then they came from the king's house unto the house of the Lord and sat down in the entry of the new gate of the Lord's house. And then in the next verse, after having discussed this, they said, you know, this man is worthy of dying. So here's the decision that seems to be coming forth. Jeremiah says, well, you know, you can, I'm in your hands. You can do whatever you want with me, but just be assured that if you take my life, you've shed innocent blood. Well, there's some further discussion that takes place, and they begin to rehearse some history with regard to what's occurred in time past, with regard to individuals who have spoken out against Jerusalem. And they go back even to Hezekiah, and they say, well, there was a prophet that spoke out against this city, and, you know, reformation was made, and so no damage, no destruction came. But then they make mention with regard to what obviously was a more recent event. For they speak in verse 20, said, there was a man that prophesied in the name of the Lord, Urijah, who prophesied against this city and against this land according to all the words of Jeremiah. Very same kind of message being brought. But what happened? Well, Jehoiakim was king. And he obviously did not like what was being said. And as a result of it, the man was afraid for his life and he fled to Egypt. And King Jehoiakim sent men after him to Egypt and brought him back and put him to the sword. And if it hadn't been for others at this point that spoke up and protected Jeremiah, very likely he would have been put to death. I'd like to think the hand of God was in this. But in any event, you can see the undercurrent that is flowing through all of this, and you can see something of the nature of the king. He makes a very interesting individual. And you see something with regard to what, in essence, was the nature of the council of those individuals who were coming before him and had an influence on him. It was certainly a mixed reaction. Councils before the king were certainly not new. Pretty much what you might anticipate. You can go back to the time of Joseph, and as he ultimately appeared before Pharaoh, there were clearly those individuals that Pharaoh relied upon. You can come forward to the time of David. And David certainly had individuals that spoken of as being counselors or friends, individuals that he relied upon. And in spite of the wisdom of Solomon, he apparently also had counselors. After his death, when Rehoboam became king, and when he was requested to lessen the burden on the people, you'll recall that the first individuals that he spoke to were the older men that were told that stood before the king. Of course, he didn't give heed to them. He talked to the younger men he had grown up with and heeded their counsel. In the time of Daniel, there were certainly those who provided counsel to the king. And, of course, it was as a result of some of the bad advice that some of them were giving because they wanted to dispose of Daniel that led to him being thrown in the lion's den during the time of Esther. But in any event, time after time, we find individuals who are in position of being counselors and of the good counsel and the bad counsel that they are giving. Is that anything that is, you know, something that's old and past? And all the counselors today that go before presidents and kings, that they're all of one mind and all giving excellent counsel? Well, we could look at world affairs and very well tell that that's not the kind of counseling that's taking place. If you read with regard to our own history, and you look at some of the presidents, you could probably pick just about any of them, but you look at people like John Adams and Andrew Jackson and Lincoln. And there's a book out in more recent years on with regard to those who served on Lincoln's cabinet and the interplay that took place. And if you look back at a number of those that served on the cabinets of presidents, that there are accounts with regard to them seeking to undermine the president. Some of them were thought of as being traitors to the nation. Clearly, some of them were trying to feather their own nest monetarily. Others were promoting themselves to be the new president after the existing one. And so on it went. And so it was that Lincoln came out, I think, as being a master of playing those rivals in such a nature as to, of course, accomplish some great things and keep this nation as one. But here was some of the interplay that was going on. If you've never served on any council or in that kind of a respect, you might not fully appreciate some of the things that can and do occur. As you look at this king, and sometimes I ask individuals to place themselves in the situation in which an individual of this nature might find themselves and ask, how would you then react in his situation when the kind of words that are being spoken of by Jeremiah are being presented? And when you have what is apparently a conflict of advice that you are receiving. And not only that, but you are in between two nations such as Egypt and Babylon. You have rebelled against Babylon when you were, first of all, had been under the tribute of Egypt, but now have been taken over by Babylon. Which way are you going to go? If you manage in overcoming or at least withstanding Babylon, or for whatever reason they withdraw, then you're still going to be under domination of Egypt. If you side with Babylon and then Babylon tends to withdraw, you're in great trouble with Egypt. Just about any decision that you might be inclined to make could end up being a terrible one. So if you are in the position of this king or any of the others during this time frame, what would you do? Well, we know that ultimately one of the things that Jeremiah was saying was that you need to simply surrender. You need to simply walk out of the gate, turn yourself over as king, the whole retinue, turn yourself over to the nation of Babylon. Would that be the advice that you would give the king if you were his counselor? We know as we look now that whether it was King Jehoiakim or any of them, when that advice was being given by Jeremiah, and we know that times that Jeremiah was called on by the kings to give advice, that's the type of advice that he would give, along with the indication that they were sinful. They needed to return to the ways of God. Let me put it in a more modern day context. Let's suppose, and many here that at least well aware with regard to the Cold War with Russia. And there were at times when indeed there were thoughts that it could easily break out into full-fledged warfare that could result in the loss of a number of cities within this country. And suppose you had an individual who was well known and generally respected, at least in a good number of quarters, that said, you know, the word of the Lord is that because you are wicked, your nation, this nation, is not what it was in time past, that you need to surrender. And you'd say, well, goodness gracious, Russia is far more sinful than we are. Why should we surrender to them? But aside from that, how would you categorize that individual that's busy saying, we need to surrender, we need to give up. There's no need for our people to die. There's no need for cities to be destroyed. Just give up. Well, I suspect that it wouldn't take long before that individual somewhere or other's mouth would be stopped. He would be called a traitor. And probably virtually everyone would think of him in that way. Picture then yourself back in the time of Jeremiah, when this is the kind of message that he is giving. And we know that he was speaking that which was right. And we know that Babylon was sinful. We know that Israel, Judah were sinful. And we can understand then why they would call him a traitor. Why some might say that he was worthy of death. And why at times they would indeed put him into prison. Were they right? Of course not. But it is a reflection on the way that people are likely to think. And so when we think in terms of today, and at times as has been mentioned, as application has been made with regard to the direction in which this nation is going, and how that it might not be difficult to foresee that at some point that God might say, I've had enough as far as the United States is concerned, that indeed God may decide to bring a punishment upon this nation as well. But that population in general might be thinking that in spite of any such messages or thoughts that we might have, you know, I just don't believe it. I don't accept it. We're basically good people. You know, we go about our business every day. But when you look overall at the nation, we're certainly far from being a Christian nation. Notice with regard to this, as you look at chapter 5 more in detail, that the message that is being spoken is not just to the king by any means, because it's indicated that it is spoken in verse 2 unto all the people of Judah and to all the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And outlining how that beginning from back in the days of Josiah and coming up through all the kings up to that present time, this was a message that was continually being spoken. Now, who is it addressed to again? All of the people. Do you know what kind of an attitude oftentimes we find today? Messages apply to everybody else, but they don't apply to me. I a lot of times use traffic laws as an example. You can go by the speed limit and be right on it, and you'll probably find that a good number of people are going right by you and about like you might be standing still. You can stop at all the stop signs, but you're likely to find a good number of other people that will coast up to the stop sign and coast right on through. You might, by all means, stop at a red traffic light only to find that others apparently feel they're hooked on to the cars in front of them and just go right on through what is obviously already turned red. And you can go on and on and on with regard to illustrations. They're eagerly going to claim ignorance, so they're going to come up with some kind of excuse. You hear, I'm sure the police hear everything with regard to such matters as, well, you know, how come you're busy stopping people like me when there are all kinds of crooks who are robbing and killing and all? Why aren't you out chasing them down? We find a reason to exclude ourselves. And I think these people were pretty much the same way. They heard, but obviously were not accepting what was being said. But you notice what God had to say to them. If there's any book that is quite clear I think the book of Jeremiah is at the top. Certainly, it's not below any with regard to clarity. And one of the things, if you have listened to very many of the lessons that have been presented, I don't think you can miss the fact that over and over and over again, it is being emphasized that God is saying, you people have gone too far. I have been patient. I have been loving. But the time has now come when my patience has reached the end, that it is no good to even pray for these people. They are going to go off into captivity, and it's going to be for 70 years. And so you might as well prepare for it. And even then telling them ultimately, including the king, you might as well just give up, because there is destruction that is coming. And that's part of what's being said here. And you notice with regard to the prophets, it wasn't just Jeremiah. There probably are prophets that were there that just aren't even named for us. But nevertheless, they were rising early, says, and sending them. But you've not hearkened nor inclined your ears to hear. These prophets were persistent and they were consistent. They were day in and day out. This was a message that was being drummed over and over again throughout the land. And not only were they doing so, but it was the same message. There wouldn't be a single individual that should ever later be able to look back and say, well, why didn't somebody tell me? Very likely, some might raise that, just as I suspect that in the day of judgment, that there are going to be those individuals who are going to say, well, why didn't you tell me? And many of them will have had Bibles that are on their nightstand that they just haven't read. And there will be many others who may have read their Bibles but really aren't paying attention to what's being said, though the message is over and over again. And there are probably a good number here who have spoken to individuals who have proclaimed the gospel to them, and yet they have not responded to it. Now notice that language is again, he tells them to turn ye every one from his evil ways, from the evil of your doings, dwell in the land that the Lord has given you and to your fathers forever and ever. And don't go after the other gods is the same message that we've been hearing lesson after lesson. And verse 7 points out the reaction that they have given, said, yet ye have not hearkened unto me, saith the Lord, that ye might provoke me to anger with the works of your hands to your own hurt. Mind you, to your own hurt. And we're in a society today, as many again have pointed out, where we have a tendency to want to shift responsibility. One of the examples, I thought it was just great when I first heard it, had to do with a professor, and I understand it was exactly the position that he took. And that was, you know, laid out the course at the very beginning of the semester at the university. The students knew what to expect, when their exams were going to be, the material that was going to be covered. And without fail, you would have somebody that would come in saying, well, you know, I couldn't do this, or I couldn't be there for this particular occasion. Obviously looking for some kind of a pass as far as the professor was concerned. My understanding was that his standard response was, that's your problem. Don't try to shift it to me and make it my problem to solve for you. And I think he had a very excellent approach. There may be some exceptions, but I think as a general rule, that's a good one. Our society, again, has that inclination. If we run into somebody with our automobile where it's every indication it looked like we should be the one at fault, immediately somebody else becomes at fault. If an individual goes into a bar and drinks too much and then has an accident, it's the bartender's fault for having served him too many drinks. People do not want to accept their personal responsibility. And God's not going to let us shift that. He didn't with these people. He said, you're doing this to your own hurt, not to God's. You're doing it to your own detriment. And that's precisely what he's telling them. Now, You notice what he has to say, and again, this is not new. He says, because you haven't listened to my words. And that's what he says, you haven't listened to my words. And many people today, as they stand before the judgment bar of God, are likely to hear the same kind of things. Because you did not listen to my words, here's what's going to happen. He says, I'm going to bring the people from the north, and they're going to bring destruction upon this area. And not only that, I'm going to make them an astonishment, a hissing, a perpetual desolation. And I will take from them the voice of mirth, the voice of gladness, the voice of the bridegroom, the voice of the bride, the sound of the millstone, and the light of the candle. The whole land shall be a desolation and an astonishment, and these nations shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. Now, during the lifetime of a number of us, we know of various instances, and some may have even been able to have been around some of these places after they have occurred. Destruction that have come naturally, such as storms that have literally wiped out larger areas, or earthquakes, or volcanoes. And certainly during wartime and the destruction that has taken cities, and that at one moment that city, perhaps there were even lights there and things were going on pretty much as normal. But by the next day, and perhaps within a very short time, the city is virtually wiped from the map. And there's still a lot of pictures around with regard to some of the cities and how they were virtually obliterated. That's something of the picture then of what is here. And hopefully we'll never live or see anything of that nature ourselves. But you can just imagine a city that is flourishing, where there is the laughter, the work that is going on daily, the children that are playing in the street, the wives that are going about taking care of the household, the husband perhaps in this instance out in the fields or caring for the animals, and then suddenly there is nothing but destruction, nothing but desolation. And these individuals, if you came into the area and traveled into that area afterwards, there would be no light, there'd be no people, there'd be no sounds, nothing but desolation. This speaks then with regard to the nature in which God will do with things. And by the way, any individual that thinks that possibly heaven or hell will not be all that bad, or that there isn't one, this is probably just a small inkling of what hell would be like. After this period of time, of course, he not only then goes on to speak with regard to the desolation that's to come to Babylon. And in the latter portion of this chapter, he speaks with regard to Jeremiah taking the wine cup of fury in his hand and causing the nations of whom he would send them to drink of it. I doubt very seriously if it was a physical cup at all. And I doubt very seriously if Jeremiah ever had the occasion, or that God ever intended that he literally visit all of those nations, and they pretty much represented the nations of that day and time. And he speaks of them as the kings of the north, far and near, with one another, all the kingdoms of the world. And very likely this represented not only, as he mentioned, Babylon itself, but those nations that were under its control. And how that even if they sought to refuse to drink, that they would nevertheless drink of the fury of God. And so it is that as Judah and Jerusalem would not escape the wrath of God, so likewise would Babylon and the nations under its control not escape the wrath of God. And most assuredly today and in the judgment day, those who have not been obedient to the Lord will not escape His wrath. Let's be sure we don't fall into that category. Thank you very much.